The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated October 11/October 18, 2021. As usual, the outer border of the front cover is in red, with a marginal white border inside. Time in the large block lettering in white is superimposed upon a blue background. It's nearly but not quite an aqua blue. And the caption, or the headline, reads, "The Enduring Hope of Jane Goodall." It is she, Jane Goodall, who is photographed in this portrait. The photography is by Nadav Condor for Time, and Goodall was photographed at her family home in Bournemouth, September 24. She's a dignified-looking woman with a wrinkly face. Somewhat gray-green eyes, I would say. She has grayish-white hair pulled back at the nape of her neck. She's wearing apparently very little makeup, just a pale, light rouge-colored lipstick. She's wearing a tan turtleneck sweater, and there's a pendant hanging around her neck or from her neck. It appears to be the silhouette of the continent of Africa, with a stone embedded in it toward the south. Her hands are clasped in front of her. Also, they are wrinkly. She's wearing an elegant pashmina with embroidery along the edges and a tapestry border in browns. The main predominant color of this garment is a beautiful teal blue. Beginning now with For the Record. "Mr. Spears has crossed unfathomable lines," said Matthew Rosengart, attorney for Britney Spears, in a September 27 statement on a recent expose by the New York Times, alleging the pop star's father had hired security to secretly spy on her. 10 to 12 years. The proposed age range for Instagram for Kids, which Facebook put on hold September 27 after public backlash. "All leaders should be you, because you are an epitome of excellence," said by the Monrovia City Council in billboards erected around the capital city of Liberia, celebrating the October 1 birthday of President George Weah. $11 billion, the annual amount the U.S. will commit to foreign aid to combat climate change by 2024, President Joe Biden announced September 21 at the U.N. General Assembly. Congress still needs to approve his proposal. "It really was uncomfortable for my results to be released publicly, before I even knew what was going on," stated by Sunny, S-U-N-N-Y, Hostin, H-O-S-T-I-N, co-host of ABC's The View, in a September 27 statement discussing a recent episode of the show, during which she was pulled off the air after testing positive for COVID-19, a result, she says, was a false positive. "If there is a relationship that you are in that might not be the best thing for you, leave it now," stated by Joseph Petito, father of Gabby Petito, in a September 26 eulogy for the 22-year-old YouTuber who was found dead in Wyoming a week earlier. "I am a fighter, and I will always be a fighter, inside and outside the ring." By Manny Pacquiao, that's P-A-C-Q-U-I-A-O, famed boxer and current senator in the Philippines, announcing September 19 he will run for the country's presidency in 2022. Good news of the week, September 20, Scotland became the first country in the world to require LGBTQ-inclusive education in its national school curriculum for primary and secondary schools. Here is the lead story, as noted on the cover, Environment, Jane Goodall, and the Tenacity of Hope, by Ciara Nugent. The photo, again, of Ms. Goodall, in the same outfit I earlier described. This time she is seated in what appears to be a library or a sitting room. There's a bookshelf next to her filled with books. A photograph on the top shelf of apparently herself, a man, and a dog. A purple hydrangea in a bud vase next to that. There is another case or shelf or armoire of some kind next to her. By the way, the walls are beige to tan. On top of which is a shelf holding stuffed toys. There's one, a feline, a bird, and a dog. Goodall has spent the past 19 months working from her attic bedroom in Bournemouth, UK. And additionally, right above Goodall's head is a framed illustration of the face of a chimpanzee. In the early years of World War II, when Jane Goodall was around 6 years old, she was often woken from her sleep by the blare of air raid sirens. The sound warned that Nazi planes were flying over Bournemouth, the English seaside town where Goodall's family had moved at the outbreak of the war. Her younger sister Judy would be up like a shot, bounding down the stairs to the bomb shelter, but Goodall refused to budge. "I did not want to leave my bed," she says. "They had to take me down with all my bedclothes." 8 decades later, Goodall, now 87, is standing in the living room of the same house, an imposing red brick Victorian building with cavernous ceilings, thick carpets, and heavy armchairs. The bomb shelter is still here, now home to a washing machine and a fridge. In the rest of the house, wooden shelves are crammed with books, figurines, and photographs. Souvenirs from Goodall's life as the world's best-known naturalist. Her grandmother bought the house in the 1930s, and it has the layer of bric-a-brac of a home occupied by the same family for many years. The new occupants on this late September morning are a camera crew moving between rooms in search of furniture to take to the garden for a photograph. Goodall, though, is still arms crossed and eyebrows raised. Her voice cuts through the commotion. Speaking softly yet with conviction, she suggests the crew try her preferred location, her attic bedroom. She exudes the same stubbornness as the girl who clung to her bed in wartime, then leads the group upstairs, victorious. Goodall's quiet determination has powered her through a lifetime of waiting for others to come around. In 1960, at 26, she sat for months in the forests of Tanzania, biding her time until chimpanzees accepted her presence and she could observe them up close. When she finally did, she made the seismic discovery they use tools, transforming our understanding of the relationship between humans and animals and catapulting her to global fame. In 1962, while pursuing her PhD at the University of Cambridge in the study of animal behavior, when professors criticized her for using human names and emotions to describe chimps, she says, "I did not confront them. I just quietly went on doing what I knew was right." Although she learned to couch her observations in more scientific language, her contention that chimps are intelligent, social animals is now widely accepted and has paved the way for much tighter restrictions on their use in lab testing. After Goodall shifted from research to activism in the 1980s, her steady, non-confrontational approach allowed her to become one of the most prolific environmentalists in modern history. She leveraged her own life story, drawing on the powerful image of a lone woman living among the animals, to get people excited about environmentalism in an era when it was a fringe activity. Through the Jane Goodall Institute, which she founded in 1977, she fundraised for habitat conservation projects, poverty alleviation programs, and animal sanctuaries. The JGI now has chapters in 24 countries, from the U.S. to the United Arab Emirates. In 2004, she became a Dame Commander of the British Empire. Along the way, she added new stories to her repertoire on history, animal behavior, human ingenuity. These, rather than protest, became her campaign tools. "If I'm trying to change somebody who disagrees, I choose not to be holier than thou," she says, perched on a well-loved armchair. "You've got to reach the heart, and I do that through storytelling." Before the pandemic, Goodall traveled 300 days out of the year to speak to school assemblies, at conferences, and on talk shows in an effort to instill some of her determination in others. Through her stories, she has built a popular brand of environmentalism centered around hope, a word that's appeared in the titles of 4 of 21 books for adults Goodall has published since 1969. A fifth comes in The Book of Hope, a survival guide for trying times, co-authored with Douglas Abrams and Gail Hudson. A memoir, Cum Manifesto, on the centrality of hope to activism. The book, coming October 19 in the U.S. and next year in the U.K., documents 3 sets of interviews between Abrams and Goodall. In their conversations, Abrams questions Goodall on how she can remain hopeful despite the environmental destruction and violent human conflicts she's witnessed, as well as the grief she's experienced in her lifetime. Goodall lost her second husband to cancer less than 5 years after marrying him in 1980. She gives 4 reasons: the amazing human intellect, the resilience of nature, the power of young people, and the indomitable human spirit, fleshing out these concepts with the color of her life. Something about her enthusiasm, the brightness of her eyes, the detail in her unusual experiences, leaves readers and audiences feeling hopeful that it is possible, with enough effort, for us to save the planet and ourselves from environmental destruction. She's an amazing woman, naturalist filmmaker David Attenborough told Time in 2019, praising her ability to inspire. She has an extraordinary, almost saintly naivete. The tenacity of Goodall's hope in the face of the crises we now endure might seem naive. Despite decades of institutional efforts and dedicated activism by millions across the globe, humans have driven the planet to the brink of ecological and climate catastrophe. With a long-awaited UN climate summit just weeks away, scientists say world leaders have failed to even pledge enough carbon emissions cuts to make a livable future, let alone begun to deliver on their promises. The situation has led a younger generation of activists to take a much more confrontational approach than Goodall's. Goodall says she understands the bleak projections from climate scientists and the economic and political structures that hinder change, but she argues that hope and her mission to spread it are nothing short of necessary for the survival of humanity. "If you don't hope that your actions can make a difference, then you sink into apathy," she says. If young people succumb to the doom and gloom, if they lose hope, that's the end. In March 2020, Goodall had just climbed into a car on the wide, tree-lined street outside the Bournemouth House, the first step on her journey to an event in Brussels. It was one of dozens of trips she'd planned for the year, which would take her to cities and forests all over the world, to her house in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and back to Bournemouth to meet with Abrams. But then her sister Judy ran out of the house and told her to come back inside. The event had just been canceled. It was the start of COVID-19 shutdowns in the UK and an abrupt end to Goodall's life on the road. The 19 months Goodall has now spent in her family home, accompanied by Judy and Judy's daughter and grandchildren, amount to the longest time she's lived there since school and the longest continuous period she stayed in any one place in decades. Over the past year and a half, she's traded hotels and auditoriums for her bedroom, a narrow attic room with a low ceiling, crowded by chests and bookcases littered with gifts and mementos, a long gray Andean condor feather, a brightly printed South American cloth, dozens of old photos. In the corner, there's a single bed where she sleeps, and within arm's reach, a narrow desk, which holds the only two totems of our time, a laptop and a ring light. Goodall's determination to spread her message has kept her up there for hours each day, doing on average 3 virtual lectures or interviews between breakfast and bedtime. That's including weekends, she says, both proud and a little weary. I even had something on Christmas Day and on my birthday. It's been hard, she says, to stare into the tiny green light of her laptop camera all day. When you're giving a lecture to 5,000, 10,000 people, you say something funny and people laugh, or you say something moving and you see eyes being wiped, she says. But if you don't get the same energy into it, there's no point doing it. If she'd had the option, Goodall says, she would have spent the pandemic period completely alone. I've always loved being by myself, she says. If I could have chosen, I would have been in a house with nobody else and a dog. She pauses to look disapprovingly at Bean, the gray whippet choosing on a chair nearby. Occasionally Bean, that's B-E-A-N, looks up, then noses back beneath a leopard print blanket to keep the light out of his eyes. Not a dog like that, Goodall says, chuckling. A proper dog. He's more like a cat. Goodall originally wanted to spend her life alone with animals. It's a dream that sent her to Tanzania's Gombe National Park in 1960. Although she had no formal scientific education, Goodall had managed to impress Louis Leakey, a renowned paleoanthropologist, with her passion for animals on a trip to Kenya with a school friend in 1957. Leakey secured funding to send Goodall to Gombe. Her observations of the chimpanzees there dispelled a then widely held belief that humans were the only animals who used tools or had emotions or personalities. After the tool discovery, Leakey famously wrote to her, "Ah, we must now redefine man, redefine tools, or accept chimpanzees as human." Goodall's mother, Margaret, came with her, answering a demand of the British research body that funded her trip for her to have a companion, and supported her daughter through the frustrating months in which the chimps ran away whenever she approached. But it was when she was alone, crawling through undergrowth or climbing mountains, that Goodall says she experienced a spiritual connection with the forest and its animals. If you are alone, you feel part of nature, she says. If you're with one other person, even somebody you love, it's two humans in nature, and you can't be lost in it. Goodall was among the last generation of researchers to spend time in the natural world before the scale of humans' impact on it became a major topic of discussion in the scientific community. In 1986, at a primatology conference she helped organize in Chicago, she attended a session on habitat loss around the world. after realizing what was going on, it was never quite the same, because then I felt I've got to try and save it. She says she still feels the spiritual connection when in nature, but there's something else there too. There's a little plea in it, a plea for help. That new understanding would transform Goodall's life, taking her from the isolation of field and library research to a frenetic schedule of travel, charity work, and activism for the next 35 years. She describes in the Book of Hope an essential realization. If she wanted to protect nature, she would have to take a humanistic approach, striving to alleviate the conditions that drive people to hunt vulnerable animals or cut down trees. In 1991, she set up Roots and Shoots, a youth activism program that now has local groups across 60 countries, in which young people are running more than 5,800 community projects to support people, animals, and the planet. 3 years later, she launched the Jane Goodall Institute's flagship conservation program, which invests in social programs in villages in Tanzania, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, and beyond, and then enlists villagers to help with tree planting and forest monitoring. Mark and Lynn Benoff, Time's owners and co-chairs, have been among Goodall's philanthropic supporters. Goodall also began advocating for widening access to birth control in order to prevent population growth from putting too much pressure on natural resources. Over the years, elements of Goodall's philosophy have attracted criticism from some in the environmental movement. Some disagree with her focus on voluntary population control in developing countries, for example, when the wealthy contribute so much more to climate change and pollution. Others see the individual lifestyle changes Goodall cites as inspiring examples of how everyone can do their bit, such as adopting a vegetarian diet or using less plastic, as a distraction from the much bigger changes that businesses and governments need to make, and a little hypocritical given how often she flies. Reflecting from her chair in Bournemouth, Goodall says she sees her ideas and her career as a pragmatic response to the crises. We need to address it on every single side we can, she says. I try to be as environmentally friendly as I can with the life that I was sort of forced to lead. I'm abridging this lengthy article now and moving to the last column of the text. A younger generation of activists has taken up more aggressive strategies to demand radical, systemic change, focusing more on the stakes for humans than for wildlife. Goodall says she can understand why young activists feel they need to be more assertive. Still, for her own part, a softer touch has always felt best, she says. But then I've never tried the aggressive route. I couldn't. It's just not me. She believes confrontational tactics can backfire, prompting those in power to pay lip service to demands without actually changing their minds. If you can get into the heart with a story you may not know at the time, but people will go on thinking. Her own story, meanwhile, continues, although not exactly in the same way as before. She will begin traveling again next year, but says she will never resume the crazy schedule she maintained before the pandemic, having found she can reach so many more people online. At 87, one never knows quite what the future holds. Still, I have good genes for a long life on both sides of my family. She will work to spread hope and inspire people for as long as she can, for the sake of future generations. I'm about to leave the world and leave it behind me with all the mess, she says. Young people have to grow up into it. They need every bit of help they can. As if remembering her mission, Goodall picks up her laptop. I want to read you a poem, she says, enlarging the text so she can see it. The piece she chooses is by Edgar Albert Gist, a rhythmic staccato quasi-nursery rhyme titled, It Couldn't Be Done. She reads with the joyful, kindly spirit of a grandmother speaking to a child, and it is hard not to feel warmed by the encouragement. Just start in to sing as you tackle the thing that cannot be done, and you'll do it. She looks up, eyes flashing. Don't you love that? Ciara Nugent wrote the article with reporting by Alejandro de la Garza and Julia Zorthian, New York, and Dan Stewart, London. From the brief, a photo here in color of the Border Patrol with Haitian migrants seeking asylum. And they encounter the mounted agents in Del Rio, Texas, September 20. There are three mounted Border Patrol agents. The horses are all brown. They're wearing, I suppose, governmental tack. It all looks the same to me. The agents themselves are dressed in black jeans, green shirts, white straw hats with the brims turned up on the sides. One of them is wearing leather chaps. The horses are reined in here. They're standing perfectly still in a field of trash. As in the foreground, several people are walking or wading into a river, or have turned around and come back from wading into the river. One is holding plastic bags, apparently filled with personal goods, above the water. The scene here looks pretty calm, except for what is probably the motion of the people in the water. The brief opener, Nation for Haitian Migrants History Repeats, by Jasmine Aguilera. In the past 11 years alone, Haitians have suffered natural disasters, rising gang violence, outbreaks of cholera and COVID-19, and political instability, including the recent assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. The crises left many in the hemisphere's poorest nation feeling they had no option but to leave, despite the difficulties they face in fleeing to other countries. In late September, Americans were confronted with the reality of those difficulties, too. An estimated 15,000 people arrived in Del Rio, Texas that month, below a bridge connecting the city to Mexico's Ciudad Acuña. A majority were Haitian nationals, migrants, and asylum seekers who ended up living in tents or under tarps in conditions similar to those in other camps that have formed along the U.S.-Mexico border in recent years. On September 24, Department of Homeland Security, DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas announced the camp had been cleared, just days after mounted U.S. Border Patrol agents were photographed confronting migrants attempting to cross into the U.S. to make asylum claims. In now viral photos and video, an agent appears to use his rein and horse to trip a migrant who falls back into the waters of the Rio Grande. Public anger over the image was immediate. The Biden administration condemned the Border Patrol agents' actions, while Mayorkas announced border agents would stop using horses and that an investigation was underway. But if the images were both shocking and new, immigration historian Brianna Nofio recognized something familiar in them. They fit in a longer pattern, Nofio says, N-O-F-I-L, a pattern she says has enabled the U.S. to build this really dramatic detention and deportation system with the intention of keeping Haitian migrants out. The founding of the U.S.'s first modern-day detention center, Nofio says, can be, in fact, largely traced back to an earlier influx of Haitian migrants who arrived in the U.S. in the 1970s, hoping to claim asylum after fleeing political instability. An estimated 56,000 Haitians arrived in South Florida in that decade, straining city and county jails past the point that local officials could manage. In response, the Carter and Reagan administrations opened several detention centers for immigrants, the first of them near Miami in 1980 to house Haitians, as well as Cubans, who had flooded into the country after Fidel Castro announced that year he'd allow them to leave. While the facilities were described as temporary fixes at the time, the first one is still functioning today as the Chrome North Service Processing Center. Nofield notes that at Chrome, that's K-R-O-M-E, Haitians lived in much more dire conditions than Cubans. The news today is in Texas, not Miami, but the U.S. approach to Haitian asylum seekers has not changed. Then and now, Haitian asylum seekers are often met with force and their asylum claims with skepticism, says Cesar Guajatamac Garcia Hernandez, a law professor at Ohio State University and author of Migrating to Prison, America's Obsession with Locking Up Immigrants. Unfortunately, I think we're seeing a newer version of a very similar phenomena in which federal immigration officials take a heavy-handed policing approach, he says, and they simultaneously cast doubt on any claims to asylum Haitians are bringing. With the camp in Del Rio cleared out, DHS has moved some of its residents to locations south of the U.S.-Mexico border, and some have been able to enter the U.S. to have their asylum cases heard. Others, however, have already been sent back to Haiti, many under Title 42, a controversial measure the Trump administration used, citing COVID-19 risk, to expel asylum seekers before granting them hearings. If Haitians are caught by U.S. immigration officials, they're typically sent back to their home country, not to Mexico like many other migrants, even though many had earlier emigrated to Brazil and other South American countries and have not lived in Haiti for years. By some estimates, the Biden administration has already expelled more Haitians back to Haiti without granting them the opportunity to present asylum claims than the Trump administration did. More than 2,000 have been flown to Haiti on deportation flights, according to DHS. To those aware of the history, these numbers can look like evidence that, despite the outcry, past trends will likely continue to hold true. I think there's always public alarm toward the most shocking images, but that does not get at the structural issue, Nofield says. How do you move beyond just these specific flashes of violence? And how do you transition that into raising larger questions about the validity of the immigration system as a whole, of borders as a whole, and of people's ability to seek asylum? Here's the brief opener. Bulletin. In a flurry of diplomacy and alliances, U.S. pivots to China. By Charlie Campbell, Shanghai. A Cold War-style prisoner exchange capped off an intense 2 weeks of Sino-U.S. wrangling. September 25, Chinese telecom executive Meng Wanzhou, who had been under house arrest in Vancouver for 3 years, touched down in her homeland. Some 6,000 miles away, Canadians Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig were being welcomed at Calgary Airport after spending a similar length of time in Chinese jails on spying charges. Both Beijing and Washington deny the release of the two men and the freeing of the Huawei CFO, who'd been fighting extradition to the U.S. on fraud charges, was a swap. The timing speaks for itself. The sudden decision of both U.S. and Canadian officials to broker such a deal has raised fears that Beijing may be tempted to detain other foreign nationals in response to affronts in the future. It is a concern that senior U.S. diplomats in China have long cited to time as a reason for not engaging in such negotiations. China hawks have since accused Joe Biden's administration of going soft on Beijing in permitting Meng's return home. September 24, Biden hosted the first in-person meeting of the Quad Nations, the U.S., Japan, India, and Australia. Beginning life 14 years ago as a low-key strategic dialogue, the grouping is now a full-fledged Indo-Pacific alliance, committed to meeting challenges to the maritime rules-based order, including in the East and South China Seas. Diplomatic parlance for standing up to China. Just a week earlier, the U.S. and the U.K. announced plans to equip their ally with tools for the job. The AUKUS pact will see Australia acquire Tomahawk cruise missiles and technology to build nuclear submarines. It is the biggest shakeup to the Asia-Pacific security architecture in decades. In an August 31 speech on the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, Biden cited the need to meet serious competition with China. Beijing appears ready for him. The forever war in Afghanistan is over, says PLA Senior Colonel Zhu Bo, retired senior fellow at the Center for International Security and Strategy at Tsinghua University. But the forever competition with China has started. From the news ticker, three short articles. Ousted, don't ask, vets given benefits. Thousands of LGBTQ veterans forced from the U.S. military under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, DADT legislation, which from 1994 to 2011 banned openly gay service members, were given new access to full government benefits September 20, the 10th anniversary of the policy's repeal. Indian farmers call for new strike. Indian farmers who've been camping close to New Delhi since November blocked roads into the capital September 27 and called for a nationwide strike to mark 1 year after Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government passed laws the farmers say benefit corporations at their expense. R. Kelly found guilty of sexual abuse. R&B artist R. Kelly was found guilty of racketeering and sex trafficking September 27. After facing allegations of sexual abuse for decades, those of us who have fought for justice for so long understand our work is not over, says Kenyetta Tisha Barnes, co-founder of the Mute R. Kelly campaign. But the truth finally prevailed. Under politics, votes for women. Despite early reports, a recount of its September 25 election results confirmed Iceland, which in 1980 was the first country in the world to directly elect a female president, had fallen just short of becoming the second country in Europe to elect a majority women parliament. Here, three countries that have hit or surpassed that milestone. This very short article is written by Eloise Barry, B-A-R-R-Y. Rwanda, the country's 2003 constitution set a 30% quota as a baseline for women in elected positions. And in 2008, Rwanda became the first country in the world to elect a majority women parliament. Mexico. Midterm elections in Mexico this past June brought gender parity to the nation's parliament, 68 years after women won the right to vote. Women also make up 49.2% of Mexico's upper legislature. Cuba. Cuban voters in 2018 elected the country's first majority women parliament, and a year later, voters overwhelmingly ratified a new constitution that enshrined freedom from gender-based discrimination and violence. Good question. To boost or not to boost, experts divided over additional dose by Alice Park. After months of anticipation, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, September 22 authorized the first booster shots of a COVID-19 vaccine from Pfizer-BioNTech for certain groups of people, at least 6 months after their last dose. 2 days later, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, followed up with its recommendations, which distinguish those who need boosters most urgently from those who will be allowed to decide for themselves if they should get an additional shot. The CDC recommends boosters for people who originally received 2 doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine and are over age 65, or live in a long-term care facility, or are over age 50 with underlying medical conditions that may make them more vulnerable to COVID-19. The agency says anyone over age 18 with health conditions or who lives or works in settings where they might be more likely to get exposed to COVID-19, such as in hospitals, schools, or grocery stores, can also choose to get a booster if they feel they need one. For now, only people who were initially vaccinated with Pfizer-BioNTech shot are eligible for a booster of the same vaccine. People who received the Moderna or Johnson & Johnson Janssen vaccines will need to wait until the FDA and CDC review data on those shots before they can line up for their boosters. Moderna has submitted its studies to the FDA, while Johnson & Johnson Janssen is still gathering data. The agencies are also waiting for results from studies exploring whether it is safe to mix and match doses of different vaccines, which will help them decide if people vaccinated with one type of vaccine can get a booster dose of another. It is certainly a confusing way to launch the booster campaign, with the CDC recommending boosters for some, allowing others to decide for themselves and leaving some to wait. But it reflects the deep disagreement among public health experts over whether everyone who's been vaccinated even needs another dose of COVID-19 vaccine at this point. Studies show that while people's vaccine-induced protection does wane several months after they get immunized, that immunity is still enough to shield them from getting severe COVID-19 or being hospitalized. Plus, it is not clear that the waning is affecting everyone equally. Both the World Health Organization and the European Medicines Agency maintain that so far the data don't show boosters are necessary for anyone other than people with compromised immune systems. They also note boosters will likely heighten inequities in vaccine coverage, as countries like the U.S., U.K., Israel, France, and Germany authorize boosters to continue to protect the already protected and potentially shift doses away from people in other countries who have yet to receive their first dose, leaving them even more vulnerable to the virus. And three more short articles from the news ticker. China outlaws cryptocurrencies. China's central bank declared all cryptocurrency transactions illegal September 24, saying they disrupt economic order. It's Beijing's latest move to limit the use of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum, after a more limited decree in May sent the coins' prices tumbling. Met debuts first opera by black artist. New York City's Metropolitan Opera performed Terrence Blanchard's opera, Fire Shut Up in My Bones, September 27, the first work by a black composer put on by the company in its 138-year history. "I don't want to be a token," Blanchard told Time of his history-making moment. "I want to be a turnkey." Fuel supply shortages hit UK drivers. Drivers seeking fuel have been forced to wait in long lines at gas stations across the UK since September 23, as a shortage of truck drivers, new visa restrictions, and the COVID-19 pandemic combined to squeeze the supply chain. The government blamed panic buying, but drew up plans to have the army deliver gas. Here's the brief milestones page. Died Melvin Van Peebles, Blaxploitation Pioneer by Andrew R. Chow. There were many who hated or even feared Melvin Van Peebles' Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. Upon its 1971 release, the X-rated film followed a black outlaw on the lam after beating up two crooked white cops and included explicit sex violence and unambiguous critiques of white power structures. Van Peebles had self-funded and starred in the project after no studios agreed to back it. Only two movie theaters in the U.S. even agreed to show it on opening night. But Sweetback would soon become a runaway box office hit, leading to the green lighting of a new wave of black films. And Sweetback would lay a foundation not just for the blaxploitation genre, but also for American experimental cinema over the next half century. Directors including Spike Lee and Quentin Tarantino have listed among their foremost influences for its ambition, confrontational, and unconventional narrative style. It gave us all the answers we needed, Lee wrote in 1991 of the film. Sweetback was just one example of the ways the fiercely independent Van Peebles, who died September 22 at 89, broke new ground. Beyond his film making, he created several successful Broadway musicals, with his spoken word songs serving as forerunners to rap. He became an options trader on the American Stock Exchange when few black men were on Wall Street, and he collaborated several times with his son, Mario Van Peebles, a leading black filmmaker of a new generation. Earlier this week, Mario Van Peebles told Time, "Sweetback made going up against the man and questioning the system hip, not just on screen, but behind the scenes." Another short column here of died actor Willie Garson, well known for his role as Sex in the City's Stanford Blatch, at 57, September 21. Richard Buckley, fashion journalist and editor, at 72, September 19. Returned, a 3,600-year-old tablet showing parts of the Epic of Gilgamesh, a sacred religious text, to Iraqi officials in a ceremony in Washington, September 23, years after it was trafficked to the U.S. Retired, the world's most accomplished professional sumo wrestler, Mongolian-born Hakuho Sho, S-H-O, at 36, September 27, after a two-decade-long career and 1,187 total victories in the ring. Completed a full forensic audit of the 2020 election results in Arizona's largest county, which found no evidence of fraud, but rather votes not previously counted for Joe Biden, noted a September 24 report. Selected, Foreign Minister Fumio Kishida, Kishida, as president of Japan's Liberal Democratic Party, September 29. From his new role in party leadership, Kishida is expected to become Japan's next prime minister. Legalized same-sex marriage in Switzerland, September 26, after almost two-thirds of voters expressed support in a nationwide referendum. Sentenced, Capital Gazette Gunman by Sean Gregory. The families of Gerald Fishman, Rob Hyason, John McNamara, Rebecca Smith, and Wendy Winters can take solace, however small, in justice. September 28, a judge sentenced Jared Ramos, who in June 2018 entered the Annapolis, Maryland newsroom of the Capital Gazette before shooting and killing five of the paper's employees, to five life sentences without parole. Ramos held a vendetta against the Capitol for its coverage of his 2011 guilty plea to harassment. The judge lauded the news organization's courage for publishing the edition of the next day, according to an account of the sentencing published in the Capitol, which continued to cover its own tragedy. The staff was named a Time 2018 Person of the Year in The Guardian's and The War on Truth. Reporter Selene Sanfelice, who survived the gunman's rampage, hiding under her desk, said, "No one could ever kill this paper." Society, Why You Are Always Tired, by Brad Stolberg, author of The Practice of Groundedness. If you're feeling more fatigued than usual, not sad or depressed necessarily, just exhausted, you are not alone. Google searches for "Why am I tired all the time?" have been at historic highs lately. There are obvious drivers like the pandemic, but I think something else is going on too. There's a lack of excitement in our lives, and we're filling that void with anxiety. Many of us are going out less because going out feels stressful and risky. Instead, bored and sluggish, we check social media. We are not doing this to learn anything specific. We just want a jolt, which often comes in the form of a horrific news story. Although this jolt can feel like excitement, it is actually anxiety. And repeated bouts of anxiety lead to deep exhaustion. But it's possible to break this cycle. Although physical fatigue often benefits from rest, psychological fatigue often benefits from action. In other words, we don't need to feel good to get going. We need to get going to give ourselves a shot at feeling good. Here is a review entitled "My Baby Daddy, the Car" by Zephanie Zakarik. You may have heard about French filmmaker Julia Ducournau's alleged film scandal, Titane, T-I-T-A-N-E, in which a sullen young serial killer has sex with a car and finds herself pregnant. The picture won the Palme d'Or, or the top prize at Cannes, in July. To be fair, other stuff happens in the movie, too. Alexia Agata Rizel, the bewildered heroine, also becomes entwined in the story of a grieving father, Fire Captain Vincent Linden, who for more than a decade has longed for the return of his lost son. Linden, a marvelous actor, radiates tenderness. His eyes hold reservoirs of sorrow deep enough to swim in, and he is also what saves the movie, at least partially, from its floundering false transgressions. Titane is designed to titillate at first with its deadpan tableau of gruesome violence, only to switch moods midstream. But Lindon aside, this surly, swaggering body horror exercise is running on empty. Roussel stalks through the movie like an automaton, even if her assertive blankness is intentional. She has all the appeal of pitted chrome. Titane only makes you think it's revving you up until you realize there's nothing going on beneath the hood. From the page entitled Light Box, it's a duo-fold photograph. It's aerial. It's got blues and grays and dark blues and dark greens and a lot of brown and very dark brown. And the lighter brown is riven with roads, or what look like roads or railroad tracks, and white and red housetops and stucco houses, perhaps. Again, it's an aerial view. And it says, "Burning a Path." The photograph is by Emilio Morinotti, Pool AP. Lava flows creep across residential neighborhoods and farmlands on La Palma in Spain's Canary Islands, September 23, 4 days after an eruption of the small island's Cumbre Vieja volcano. Hundreds of homes and buildings were destroyed and thousands forced to leave over 10 days of volcanic activity. The Canaries government chief, Angel Victor Torres, described the impacted area as a catastrophe zone. Officials said September 28, lava had reached La Palma's shoreline and was spilling into the Atlantic Ocean, releasing huge steam clouds and potentially toxic gases. The volcano is apparently up here in the cloud-shrouded dark green area, and flowing from it, from top to bottom on this photograph, is this brown blob. It looks like a mile or maybe more wide mud flow. It is the lava. It has inundated some buildings. The buildings that are left in this lava flow are on little tiny islands. Perhaps they're at higher elevations than the surrounding area. It is encroaching upon many more buildings and what appear to be small fields, perhaps vineyards. They're enclosed with walls of stone, I think. Again, it's an aerial photo. Much of the ground itself is volcanic sediment, apparently, because it's brownish, with small patches of green, some of which are surrounding these what appear to be tiny white houses with red roofs, red tile perhaps. It is just an extensive scene of destruction. And yet on the edges, where the lava flow has not gone, everything looks intact. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.